This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank. Focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When you borrow money to buy something, you better be able to pay it back. Private equity firms have borrowed hundreds of billions of dollars to buy companies the last couple of years. So far, no problem. It's been quite a party. But today we have signs that some of the guests might be leaving. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, June 27th. Glad you can join us. Private equity, private equity, private equity. It's been the story on Wall Street and often this program. A lot of those deals have been paid for with borrowed money. But the people loaning that money are starting to say, wait a minute, there's too much debt here. Yesterday, underwriters of a $1.5 billion bond pulled the plug on a deal. It was the buyout of a big company called U.S. Food Service. Amy Scott has more from New York.
The takeover of U.S. Food Service is a classic leveraged buyout. The buyers are paying for the company by loading it up with debt. But yesterday, potential investors in some of that debt didn't go for it. Bankers canceled the company's bond offering, and the Wall Street Journal says the company shelved plans to sell $2 billion in loans. Chris Donnelly follows the buyout market for Standard & Poor's leveraged commentary and data. He says investors didn't like the way the deal was put together. Too much debt, not enough return, and too few provisions to warn investors if things start to go wrong.
Those deals have become so aggressively structured that investors felt that the market was becoming too overheated.
The deal won't fall apart. Donnelly says investment banks will loan U.S. Food Service the money directly. It's part of the deal they made to win the underwriting business. U.S. Food Service isn't the only company responding to nervous investors. In the past week, others have scaled back debt offerings and added investor protections. Eric Hirsch is chief investment officer at Hamilton Lane. The company invests in buyout funds. He's not ready to call this a trend.
You know, sometimes this is where the crack begins. My view right now is that this is much more of a case-by-case commentary on specific transactions, though.
Some analysts think the pushback could slow down the buyout boom and the wider economy. According to Thomson Financial, just 7 deals were announced on Monday this week, compared to 43 a week earlier and 84 2 weeks before that. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
All right, now that we've started with some private equity doom and gloom, let's talk out the other side of our mouth. Today, a big private equity deal on Wall Street. The company being bought, Guitar Center. Guitar Center started almost half a century ago as a small appliance and organ shop in Hollywood. So how does it go from that to a company worth $2 billion? Rachel Dornhelm looked into it.
The name is a little misleading. Guitar Center also stocks drums, band instruments, software, and digital recording equipment. Retail analyst Alex Beseda says the buyer, private equity firm Bain Capital Partners, likely made a shrewd move, scooping up the country's largest musical instrument retailer.
Guitar Center, because it's successful, it has cash, it has been buying up smaller competitors, and so it looks like Bain is getting kind of a big fish.
But how does a big box store play with stereotypically countercultural musicians?
You know, stereotyping musicians as well is that get anything they can as cheap as they can.
That's Michael Melinda, editor-in-chief of Guitar Player magazine. He says in addition to rock-bottom pricing, Guitar Center has boomed on sales of technology that gives people the chance to record and distribute their own music. He says in the past, beginners bought a bad guitar and bad amp and sounded bad. Now, Melinda says there are all sorts of digital products that are addictive.
Once you get in, it's kind of hard to get out. You just kind of keep trying to, you know, buy things that make you sound better or play better.
And while musicians might have once found it unthinkable to buy instruments without trying them first, Melinda says Guitar Center has also grown by offering online sales. I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace.
After a decade of Tony Blair, Britain has a new prime minister. Today, Blair handed the reins to Gordon Brown. Brown was Blair's finance chief. He's been highly praised for the way he ran the British economy. But Brown has always coveted the prime minister's job. So now that he's moved into number 10 Downing Street, how will he run the country? Our man in London, Stephen Beard, reports.
For the first time in a decade, the prime minister posing outside 10 Downing Street is not Tony Blair. He certainly isn't. The cameramen had to shout at Brown, telling him to wave and smile. Unlike Blair, Brown is an awkward performer. But, as analyst Howard Wealdon, Brown has a much better grasp of economics than all his recent predecessors.
The new prime minister is, of course, a man who has more experience of finance, industry, business than any other, probably over the last 50 years.
And, says David Frost of the Chambers of Commerce, Brown's been generally popular with British business.
We've had a good period of stability. Business wanted that. They wanted an end to boom and bust. They've got that, and it's enabled them to plan.
The voters are less happy. As finance chief, Brown poured record sums of taxpayers' money into the National Health Service, or NHS, and into education. But people say these public services are not much better than before. As prime minister, Brown says he's got the message.
I've heard the need for change. Change in our NHS. Change in our schools.
But, says Howard Wealdon, just as Gordon Brown leaves the Treasury and takes over the top job, Britain's economic prospects are darkening, interest rates rising ominously.
We are entering a very difficult period now. The future will be very different from the past. Now we've got to see whether he can handle it.
In his first speech as Prime Minister, Gordon Brown quoted his old school motto, "I will try my utmost." Compare that modest pledge with the soaring rhetoric of Tony Blair on the day he won power.
A new dawn has broken, has it not?
Today, the more modest-looking Brown era began. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, after a three-day slump, today investors decided they'd had enough. Time to buy. We'll break it down when we do the numbers. This might be the duh moment of the show. People are writing fewer checks. But you might not know that it's affecting some people's lives. Today, the Federal Reserve said it's going to close almost all of its 22 check processing centers. They'll leave only 4 of them open. Pat Barron is in charge of check processing operations at the Fed. Pat, this shift away from paper seems obvious, but is there something the banks are doing to speed it up?
More and more banks today are beginning to take paper checks in as deposited items and convert those to electronic items. That expedites the presentment of that, and it mitigates some of the need for existing processing infrastructure, be it at the Federal Reserve or in the private banking community more broadly.
So are these check processing centers going to be converted into something else?
The Federal Reserve, along with many of the private sector processing centers, are making this transition from paper-based processing, which is very labor-intensive, very equipment-intensive, to electronics, which is far less equipment and labor-intensive. So the Federal Reserve, like many other organizations, will continue to provide significant clearings as it relates to electronics and converted items. The Federal Reserve and many other organizations are investing extensively in the new technologies that will provide those services.
How many people are going to lose their jobs over this?
We are forecasting that over the next 4 years, we would probably downsize in the neighborhood of 1,700 jobs from where we are today. And, you know, as the transition begins to mature in years going forward, you know, there's obviously the possibility that we would continue to downsize as our nation moves from paper to electronics.
All right, Pat Barron, head of check processing operations at the Federal Reserve. Thanks so much.
Sure thing.
This week, the Supreme Court struck down a key restriction on campaign ad spending. This has to do with TV ads that appear right before an election. Some people are worried the court has opened the floodgates to a barrage of last-minute issue ads. But commentator Robert Reich says they're missing the real issue here.
Until the 1960s, presidential candidates were usually chosen in conventions. Then state primaries became the deciding force. But now even the primaries are declining in importance, and the real nominating process is happening elsewhere and earlier, in quarterly reports filed with the Federal Election Commission showing how much money each candidate has raised during the year before the convention. The quarterly totals tell the big contributors— lobbyists, corporate PACs, and partners of large financial firms, where the smart money is going. And they follow with more money. No one wants to be left out. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, a little like investing in commodity futures, hog bellies, soybeans, and presidential candidates. By placing their bets early and accurately, these investors secure a seat at the winner's table. This means special access and influence, or at least the appearance of such, which is almost as useful. This presidential election is already turning out to be the most expensive in history. And although the campaigns trumpet how many small donors they've rounded up, the leading candidates in both parties are relying mostly on big donors, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. So what can we do? The best idea I've heard comes from Bruce Ackerman of Yale Law School. Essentially, he wants to require that all contributions be put into blind trusts for each candidate, so candidates can use the money but cannot know who contributed what. Get it? This way, the fat cats can support whomever they want, and their First Amendment free speech rights are protected, but no one gets a seat at the winner's table because the winners won't know who they're beholden to.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. He was labor secretary under President Clinton. We welcome your thoughts at marketplace.org. You may have heard about Dubai's push to become a big tourist destination in the Middle East. The United Arab Emirate is now number two behind Egypt. But what vacation spot would be complete without a Hooters restaurant? A Kuwaiti investor has been trying to open one in Dubai, but today a local newspaper said it's probably not going to happen. Apparently the powers that be won't approve a restaurant that clashes with Muslim religion and culture. Oh, well, Americans still love their Hooters, right? I don't know. A bunch of Hooters restaurants in New England have suddenly shut down. From WBUR in Boston, Kurt Nickisch reports.
No more tight tank tops and hot orange shorts. No more specially televised swimsuit pageants above the bar. No more steamy piles of chicken wings. In all, 12 Hooters restaurants around New England have closed their doors, and that doesn't surprise Andy Aylesworth. He's a marketing professor at Bentley College.
We're the home of the Puritans, the Salem Witch Trials, Harvard, Boston Blue Bloods. From a demographic point of view, I'm not sure that Hooters in New England is a good fit.
For the record, Aylesworth has only been to Hooters once. He walked in the door with his 2-year-old as a joke and then walked right out again. His wife thought it was a real hoot. But the fact that Hooters is not a family restaurant is one reason that nationally the chain is growing. Despite a downward trend in the industry, Hooters sales ballooned more than 6% last year.
Given the way the economy and the restaurant business is going, you know, anything over 3%, 4% in a year is a pretty good showing.
That's Scott Hume, editor of Restaurants and Institutions magazine. He says while middle-tier restaurants like Chili's and Applebee's have been struggling lately, Hooters sales have grown to almost $1 billion annually because, Hume says, the restaurant offers more than a meal.
It benefits in part from being a good time place. Let's go out, let's have some beers, let's have some chicken wings. You've got a lot of people who look at that as being an affordable luxury.
And they look at the waitresses, too. Still, here in New England, there were not enough people looking. Mel Hoffman is an attorney who represents the owners of the bankrupt franchises here. Hoffman says it was hard to find anyone to buy them out.
To have restaurants go dark overnight, this is a tremendous black eye for Hooters of America.
The CEO of the parent company blames the local franchise owners. He says Hooters will try to reopen in New England, and they have to, says editor Scott Hume.
It's too big a chunk of the country not to have the brand represented in it.
When Hooters does come back, marketing professor Andy Aylesworth suggests the company try a different tack, starting with the restaurant's slogan.
Hooters tagline, delightfully tacky and unrefined. What a great tagline. We're in New England. New Englanders, they like to think of themselves as refined.
Maybe the waitress uniform could use some stiff white collars and shoes with buckles to be a little more appetizing. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Coming up, some firefighters say a certain fire retardant is a lifesaver. Others worry it's a poison, but the maker of it calls all that a smokescreen.
Frankly, we have a product that we believe has been beneficial to them that is under global attack.
But first, let's do the numbers. The market's got a bit of a lift today from tech stocks and a rise in oil prices. That sent energy shares up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 90 points, about 2/3%, to close at 13,427. The NASDAQ bounced up 31, about 1.25%, to end the day at 2605. The S&P 500 rose 13, about 1%, to 1506. Exxon and ConocoPhillips were both up about 2%. Shares in Oracle climbed almost 3% after the company gave a solid earnings report. And Nike rose 8% on a great profit report. We talked about concerns over private equity. Well, Blackstone Group, which just IPO'd, its shares sank 2.7%. But Guitar Center rocked up nearly 20%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note slipped to 5.08%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Science and technology reports are supported by Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at the events for Thursday. Democratic presidential candidates duke it out in a debate at Howard University. The House Small Business Committee holds a hearing on how the Copyright Royalty Board's decision to increase royalty rates impacts recording artists and internet radio stations. And on this day in 1919, Germany signed the Treaty of Versailles, ending World War I. I'm Sitar Nevis.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Kai Rizdahl. Today we found out exactly how many people on this planet are millionaires. 9.5 million people. About a third of them live in the United States. Last year, the U.S. saw a 9% increase in the number of millionaires over the year before. And those people control a lot more money. This came out in a report from Merrill Lynch and Capgemini today. Joining us to talk about it is Robert Frank. He writes the Wealth Report column for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being here, Robert.
Thank you.
The rich getting richer. Pardon me for being brusque, Robert, but tell us something we don't know.
The rich are getting richer, and what's happened that we really don't know or that we underestimated was the speed with which the rich are getting more numerous. The number of millionaires has been the real story over the past 10 years, and we saw that continue in 2006. In the U.S., as you mentioned, 9% growth. Worldwide, 8% growth. These growth rates are 2 and 3 times the growth rates of those economies.
Yeah, I was reading that China, of course, Russia, India, that's where we're seeing the most growth in the number of millionaires.
The growth rate for each of those countries is astounding, you know, 20%, and in China, also strong, 8% or so. But when you look at the U.S. compared to those countries, the U.S. is still far and away the leading producer of millionaires in the world. You know, China has 345,000 millionaires, India about 100,000. The number of millionaires in India is about the same as the number of millionaires in the state of Ohio.
So where are they making their money?
Well, we certainly have some tips on how they're investing. And over the past year, they made some significant shifts in their investments that the rest of us might want to take notice of. For instance, they moved money out of hedge funds and private equity funds, so-called alternative investments, and they put more and more money into real estate.
So, yeah, that sort of flies in the face of all we're hearing about private equity, hedge funds. That's all we hear about these days.
That's right, but it's possible that the wealthy are getting better information than the rest of us.
Well,
they may understand that private equity and hedge funds returns are slowing, fees are increasing, the lending markets are getting so where private equity and hedge funds are having a difficult time leveraging, and real estate may actually be a good long-term play. So they may know things that you and I don't.
So what is good about having this many millionaires?
Well, I got to think about this for a minute, what's good about it. I mean, one of the impacts of having all this wealth is more and more trickle down. Now, clearly, this hasn't been enough trickle down to address inequality issues in America.
That's a dangerous term Robert.
Inequality.
No, trickle down.
Oh, trickle down, right. But what we are seeing is a growing economy built around the wealthy. There is in America today a shortage of yachts, a waiting list for Ferraris, for Gulfstream jets. The starting salary for a butler today is $80,000. There is so much demand at the high end for services and products that serve the wealthy that it is creating jobs and economies for the rest of America.
Okay, Robert Frank. He writes the Wealth Report column for the Wall Street Journal. His book is called Richestan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yesterday, we told you about an industrial chemical that's probably in your body. It's a flame retardant found in most homes. It keeps appliances and electrical wiring from catching fire. We don't know for sure if this chemical causes health problems, but a lot of firefighters want to get rid of it anyway because of the fumes it gives off when it burns. Sasha Aslanian of American Radio Works has the second part of our series.
Firefighters have a big voice in any public debate over flame retardants. That's because they put their lives on the line. Mike Stockstead is head of the Professional Firefighters Union in Minnesota, one of the states that considered a ban on the flame retardant chemical DECA this year. He says DECA poses an unacceptable risk to firefighters.
yes, we have self-contained breathing apparatus while we're fighting the fire, but our aerobic capacity is reduced 40% when we put this equipment on. So after the fire, we're already exhausted. Oftentimes, we have to take this equipment off to do the cleanups. We're still breathing them.
No studies prove DECA is a health risk for firefighters, but it has been shown to harm brain development in animals. Tests have found the chemical in most people's bodies. The largest organization of rank-and-file firefighters in the U.S., the International Association of Firefighters, says there are safer flame retardants that could be used instead. But Washington State firefighters saw their former fire marshal testify before their state legislature earlier this year on the other side, against a ban.
My name is Tom Brace. I feel that I've come home in a sense. I was the Washington State director of the state fire marshal's office.
And Tom Brace is now the executive director of the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association. What he didn't say is that he's also a paid industry lobbyist. Two other people from fire safety groups who testified that day made the same omission. Brace says he signed on to lobby for the companies that make flame retardants because he doesn't want fire safety sacrificed in an environmental debate.
I would be less than candid with you if I told you that when fire safety and the environment interface, at least based on history, fire safety issues become secondary. And I'm concerned about that because I'm a fire guy.
I guess I felt that the brotherhood and sisterhood of firefighting is betrayed.
Mike Stockstead of the Firefighters Union says firefighters in Brace's home state were stung by his decision to serve as a paid lobbyist while representing the fire chiefs.
We're not interested in selling our opinion or our name. Our allegiance is to the public and to our firefighters, their health and safety.
The flame retardant industry group that hired Brace, the Bromine Science and Environmental Forum, has forged other ties with firefighters. It makes charitable donations to fire groups. Industry lobbyists serve on boards and committees for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation and the National Association of State Fire Marshals. Environmentalists criticize the industry group's tactics. Kenny Bruno is with the Environmental Health Fund.
It's a very cynical strategy because nobody's proposing to weaken fire safety standards. But it's also a very clever strategy because everyone really respects the fire community and these officials have great credibility.
A spokesman for the Bromine Science and Environmental Forum defends the group's strategy. John Kite says it's only natural for companies that make DECA to form alliances with fire safety organizations and firefighters groups.
Frankly, we have a product that we believe has been beneficial to them that is under global attack.
DECA has been banned in Sweden. After lobbying from environmentalists and industry groups in the U.S., 9 states considered DECA bans this year. 2, Washington and Maine, passed restrictions. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Sasha Aslanian for Marketplace and American Radio Works.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, if you're addicted to video games, you're not officially an addict. Today, the American Medical Association decided not to classify obsessive video game playing as a mental illness. In extreme cases, video gamers stop eating, going to work, showering. Sure sounds like an addiction, but the doctor said they needed to do more research and will reevaluate in 5 years. Until then, you gamers might not be addicts, but we would appreciate it if you take a shower. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow ticked up 90 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ rose 31, about 1.25%. The S&P 500 jumped 13 points, about 0.1%. Our engineers are Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba. Next time, a controversial plan to bring young people back to the tube in China.
We discussed the risk of irritating certain group of people. The traditional value, family value of Chinese society does not accept gay as a viable way of life.
I'm Scott Jagow.
Please join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.